This morning, we'll be talking with an investigative journalist who's written a book on the subject, who argues that the drug companies had good reason to believe that there was potential for harm in these drugs and that they made them available anyway. She also argues that the FDA failed in its responsibility to look out for the interests of consumers. Our guest is Alicia Mundy. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for Media Week. She's also contributing editor at Washingtonian and has written stories for U.S. News and World Report, with Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post. She was, between 88 and 89, a member of the investigative unit at U.S. News and covered a number of different stories. She's joining us this morning by telephone to talk with us about her new book, which is titled Dispensing with the Truth. The subtitle is The Victims, the Drug Companies, and the Dramatic Story Behind the Battle over Fen-Phen. It's published by St. Martin's Press and is out now in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. Questions are also welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And again, if you match the numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL, which probably doesn't really make it easier, but at any rate, it's 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Ms. Mundy, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Fen-Phen has been out of the news for a while now, and it could very well be that unless people had some personal experience with it or knew somebody who did, they might not know what it is we're talking about. So we probably ought to go back and do the basics and talk about just exactly what it is and what it did or does.
I'll be glad to. And one of my concerns is that it is out of the news, and yet people who think they have no symptoms right now and think they've missed the speeding bullet might not be in such good shape. So I'm very interested in putting out the word that, you know, don't forget about Fen-Phen because the problems aren't over yet. Fen-Phen was actually two drugs that had both been on the market a long time, and basically their sales had flatlined because they had a couple of immediate side effects that made people stop taking them. One half of them was called Pondamin, and it was made by a company called Wyeth-Erst, which brings you Advil and Robitussin and other good things. And the other half was called Phentermine. Pondamin put you to sleep. One of the people who researched serotonin for years said, of course it helps you lose weight. You sleep for 18 hours. Phentermine, which was the other half of Fen-Phen, was basically a form of speed, and it made you jumpy and kept you awake. So, not surprisingly, people weren't buying either drugs because they couldn't stand either being jumpy or being asleep all the time. And in 1992, a doctor got the smart idea that if you combine the two drugs, they knock out each other's initial side effects. You're not sleepy, you're not jumpy, and you lose weight. What wasn't known at the time when that medical study came out, which then eventually ended up in the mainstream press, women's magazines, Reader's Digest, et cetera, was that study had in part been funded by one of the drug companies that was a co-owner of Pondamin at the time. So in the mid-1990s, early to mid-1990s, suddenly these drugs, which hadn't been sold for quite a while or which hadn't been used, suddenly became quite popular, and you could begin to see then what the other real side effects were. In addition, the company Wyeth-Erst, which made Pondamin, had in the pipeline at the FDA a new and improved version of that drug called Redux. That was in the pipeline, and they were trying to get that approved, figuring, hey, great, we'll have two streams of income. We've got Pondamin, which has been out there and wasn't selling for years until, you know, about 94, and then we'll have Redux, the new improved version that we hope doesn't put people to sleep immediately. And, look at all the money we're going to have. And Wall Street predicted sales of possibly up to $1 billion a year once everything was settled and going. So that's the long answer to your short question. Tell us about the drug. Mm.
And I guess it's my understanding that the part of this drug combination that really causes the problems is the first Fen, the fenfluramine.
It's fenfluramine, which again was sold under the trade name Pondamin. And Redux was another version of fenfluramine called dexfenfluramine. They were both taken off the market in mid-September of 1997. The other drug, made by a different company, Phentermine, the one that was a version of Speed, remains on the market to this day, It does not appear to be the culprit for either the fatal lung disease which these drugs caused or the heart valve damage which the drugs caused.
Mm-hmm. And the Pondiman had been around for a while, and as you say, it hadn't done terribly well because it had the side effect that it had a sedative side effect, and it wasn't
right.
until it really took off when somebody had this idea to put the two things together, the Pondiman with the Phentermine, which was the stimulant, and then somebody was looking at this and thinking, well, you know, if we could just, it was a chemist who looked at the Fenfluramine and he said, you know, if we could just fix that so it didn't put people to sleep, then we'd really have something. So
I hate to say it. I always use this example, but for people who survived the drug years of the 60s, it was the equivalent of combining your puppy upper with a doggy downer. You know, you didn't quite knock yourself out, and that's basically what happened here. The doggy downer was Pondiman, and the puppy upper was Phentermine. And of, you know, of course, it, you know, on paper, it looked like a good idea.
Hmm. Well, they did. Here, I guess here's the big question: the people that were making Pondiman, did they have any reason to believe that there was this potential for causing this problem with heart valves, which eventually it was obvious that it was doing?
Yes, we can go straight to heart valves, or I can tell you first about the lung disease, whichever you prefer. But the heart valve problem, which the company has now settled, I think it's admitted that it's publicly settled 45,000 cases of the heart valve disease, and then I believe in Wall Street presentations, I've been told that there's another, I guess, maybe 20-some thousand cases in addition to that. And then I think the latest numbers on the number of people who have gone into the mass settlement to get testing, in some cases to get damages or get medical support, is I think it's over 300,000 right now. And the number of deaths from different things, mostly from the lung disease, now is about five times the number of deaths from Firestone. It's I think the FDA had given me a rough estimate of about 500. So you've got, you know, these figures to deal with. They're fairly large, and the question is, you know, what did the company know? With the heart valve damage, there were reports coming in Europe where both of these drugs, both Pondiman and Redux, were already on the market and had suddenly regained a lot of popularity in the 90s, and Redux had come on the market there in the late 80s. The company, because it was in an alliance with a European drug company that made these drugs, it was getting reports about different cardiovascular problems and valvulopathy problems. And for various reasons, some of which have been rationalized and some of which haven't quite been fully explained, did not initially send a lot of these reports on to the FDA, you know, clearly labeled valvulopathy, clearly labeled valve problems. The FDA has to operate with the drug companies on an honor system. You determine, if you're the drug company, you determine which side effect you want to tell the FDA about first. You know, what's the big label you're going to put on this? And in different ways, the valvulopathy cases, as they were coming in, were either ignored or basically overlooked, and were not flagged to the FDA as the FDA had hoped they would be, which is, hey, there's a new serious problem. In some cases, people have ended up in the hospital with cardiac problems. This is not on the label of the drugs, and we need to flag this to you. And these reports were coming in, again, at the time when the company was in a critical situation financially, in the sense that its new drug was in the pipeline at the FDA waiting for approval. And here are these reports coming in from Europe of different things that, when you go through the list of what else they had caused, there's listings of heart and cardiac problems.
Hmm.
So, yes, so there was definitely stuff there early on.
What I was going to do is go on and ask the question that it seems that certainly that there is a real failure in the process here when it comes to now where they're proposing the introduction of Redux, which is a related to that related to Pondamin, but different. It's a new drug product, so you would think, well, here there would be, have been yet another opportunity to realize there was potential problem with these drugs and that the FDA, somewhere in the process of testing and approving them, should have picked up on the fact that there was a problem, and one would have hoped that Redux then never would have gone onto the market.
There were a number of signals of different things going on with the FDA, and one of the most important was initially the fatal lung disease, which these drugs caused, which is supposed to be very rare, but new studies were coming in from Europe saying, my God, the people who take these drugs are getting this lung disease all over the place, and look, you're only supposed to see 1 to 2 cases per million of this fatal lung disease in the normal population, and with people who take the drugs, it's 20 to 30 times that, and the longer they stay on the drugs, we're seeing it go up to, you know, we see the potential of 100 cases per million here. The longer they stay on the drugs, this is bad news. There were people inside the FDA who were trying desperately to get the first drug off the market, to get the new drug that was in the pipeline to not be approved, and at the very least to have a very, very strong warning label on with a big black box around it that is one of the only things doctors notice when they look at labels, according to studies, is that they'll, you know, they basically, doctors don't have time to read the labels. If they see something in a black box or great big black print, they pay attention. And then they know you don't prescribe these drugs unless it's for a life-threatening condition, and these were lifestyle drugs. So there were people at the FDA really trying to do something with these drugs, but they were being overruled by the people at the top of the FDA who are somewhat political, who tend to be part of the revolving door process. You leave the FDA and you get a fat, fancy job in industry. And in the meantime, the drug company was all over the place with their lawyers and their lobbyists and other lawyers and lobbyists and, you know, eventually, you know, basically looking to Congress for help.
Let me introduce again real quick our guest here for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Alicia Mundy. She is the Washington Bureau Chief for Media Week. She's also contributing editor at Washingtonian Magazine. She's written for a lot of other publications. We're talking about her new book, which is titled Dispensing with the Truth, which talks about the diet drug Fen-Phen and how it is that it came on the market and continued to be on the market for a couple of years, even though there were indications that there was potential harm. It was eventually withdrawn, and there has been there were a number of lawsuits that have been settled also at this point.
Literally thousands upon thousands. Mm.
So, and questions are welcome here for people who are listening, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I guess one of the things that it makes one think about, and I think maybe we prefer not to think about it when it comes to new medications, but I think it is fair to say that when a new medication has been approved, before it goes on the market, it's been taken by a relatively small number of people, and that in a way,
right,
the first couple of years is still de facto testing because you don't really know what's going to happen until large numbers of people take it.
That's an excellent point, and a couple of FDA doctors have said to me, you know, and will say to anyone who asks them, if you take a drug within the first year or so that it's been on the market, you're basically now an unpaid guinea pig. Under all the pressure from Congress, which gets so much millions of dollars from the pharmaceuticals for the election campaigns and everything, there's really been a speeded up process at the FDA in recent years to try and get drugs through. And the trouble is the drugs that are getting through aren't always the life-saving drugs that you think, well, of course, let's hurry up the approval on cancer drugs because people are dying and they need these drugs. And if they have a few problems, you know, at least we know it's all in a good cause. But, you know, what's really getting pushed through very quickly are these lifestyle drugs. We're talking, you know, hair loss, skin rashes, 15 versions of an allergy drug, male impotence, weight loss drugs. And that sort of thing. And those are getting pushed through rapidly with what is now very little testing. The FDA has basically been defanged and declawed in recent years, and they're not allowed to demand a lot from the companies anymore in terms of clinical testing. And again, so it all comes down to the honor system. You have to hope the tests such as they do are done quickly and efficiently and appropriately. Companies, if they think they're getting too much pressure from the FDA to do more testing, don't hesitate to bring their lobbyists into Congress and say, you know, fix it for us, and quite frequently it gets fixed. And you know, you have a situation where it's where you have a very dangerous situation for Americans. If you're going to indulge in some of these non-life-saving drugs, you've got to understand that you're probably a guinea pig in the first couple of years.
Mm. Well, and it does, when you think about this particular case, you do have to wonder how, to what degree, in the thinking of the people at the FDA, they thought about just how much demand there was for this, for someone that would, for a drug that would do this, that is, that would assist in weight loss. And I was sort of struck in going back at looking at some of the, a few of the articles that were published, say, in 1997, at the time that the word was, people were now putting out the word that says, this is a bad drug, don't take it. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, there were stories that said, this is a bad drug, it could kill you, don't take it. But on the other hand, a lot of the reporting was almost nonchalant in the way it said, oh, well, that didn't work, now let's go out and find something else.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And part of this, you know, the FDA, in the case of this drug, and you know, what I chronicled in the book here is, you know, the odd way in which Redux got approved. The FDA turned it down the first time when it's outside advisory committee, and then something that's almost never done, somebody at the FDA said, well, let's have a second committee and we'll revote. And they brought in more people for the second committee meeting who hadn't made the first one, and this time it slipped through with one vote. And you look at what the pressure was at the time. What had happened is that drug companies now routinely fund what I call front groups. Other people will politely call them advocacy groups. They're basically front groups, and there have been a number of excellent articles written about them by different papers around the country. But in this case, obesity groups getting funded from the drug companies were all over the FDA, as you would say, like, you know, cheap perfume, saying, obesity kills. You know, you've got to get this drug for us. We have people keeling over right, left, and in between from obesity. And it was this massive campaign. The obesity groups were going to congressmen and congresswomen saying, you know, you've got to help us. You've got to recognize there's a national epidemic of this. There has to be support for obesity drugs. We'd like to get Congress to force insurance companies to pay for obesity drugs. So, you know, in this atmosphere, you can see how this happens. You know, there's just so much pressure going on. But at bottom, it's being funded by the drug companies who have a very special interest in getting some of these drugs out there. And, you know, and that's what's going on. It's a massive PR campaign. I must admit it's a brilliant PR campaign, but, you know, if only they use their powers for good instead of evil, as we say.
Well, you really, in the book, make a very serious charge, and that is essentially that the drug company knew that there was potential for harm in these drugs, but basically didn't care. They saw this as an opportunity to make a lot of money.
Let me give you, in a nutshell, a couple of the documents, because this book, I want to stress strongly, you know, is not based on me interviewing nameless people in a garage at midnight. This book is based on thousands of the company's own incredible documents and hundreds of hours of either the courtroom testimony or the depositions of its own company's executives. And what the documents show is that, and I'm going to go back to the fatal lung disease first because that's the easiest thing to concentrate on, and as a matter of fact, the number one clinic for this fatal lung disease in all the world happens to be right there, not close to you, but pretty close, in Chicago, the Rush Clinic in Chicago attached to St. Luke's. So they track these diseases. But the company was getting these reports. There's new reports coming in from Europe that the number of this disease that's supposed to be rare are, you know, just jumping up there. And the FDA is seeing this as well, and the FDA doctors are trying to say, we've got to do something about the label that's been on this drug that says there's four lousy cases possibly linked to this disease, when we're hearing there's 40 and 50, and as it turns out, the company's own records were showing at one point close to 100. And the drug label was just finally being changed to reflect that there might be an increase in this disease. But what the company's documents show is that their market research in the meantime is scurrying around going, the FDA wants us to put a black box warning label on. That's the strongest warning label you can see on a drug. And they want us to warn about this lung disease. And our market research shows that, you know, we could end up forfeiting about $800 million in sales over the next couple of years if this box is forced on us, if this strong warning label is forced on us. We could lose 50% of our sales. Our interviews show that doctors will be reluctant to prescribe this drug easily if this terrible warning label is there, and therefore, according to yet another document, we will do everything in our power to neutralize the people at the FDA who want to force this label on us. And when, in the end, the company wins its battle, there's, you know, an appropriate memo celebrating the success of the SWAT team in getting no black box. And you see what happened here, one, you know, sort of one memo after another. I think my favorite, the one I certainly intend to frame, at one point in October of 96, when at this moment the numbers are going up about this lung disease, there's been a report in the New England Journal of Medicine, co-authored again by the doctor from Chicago, about, you know, the potential risk, the number of cases they've seen in Europe. Somebody at the company, a supervisor at the company, writes her boss an email, and she complains, "Do I have to spend my waning years writing checks to fat people worried about a silly lung problem?" That silly lung problem has killed hundreds of people. And you just stand back and you go, what was going on here? What was the thinking inside the company? It was almost a year before those drugs were withdrawn after that memo was written.
Hmm. Well, how much money did they make compared with how much money they paid out as a result of lawsuits?
Very little in the end. I think at one point one year's sales were, oh, God, it's hard breaking it down. I think perhaps 250 to 300 million. And then the potential sales, according to Wall Street, were supposed to go up heavily the following year. Unfortunately, that was the year 97 when all of a sudden the reports are coming in now of new problems and what have you. But in the end, the company has now paid out, I believe it told Wall Street last month, over $11 billion for this, you know, in terms of everything from paying the lawyers to paying for damages. $11 billion, which I think you can buy a small equatorial country for that. And there's still more to come, because there is this huge mass settlement. I want to tell your listeners out there, if you took the drugs 2 months or longer, you will probably qualify for this. You don't even need a lawyer. You get on the web and you go to settlementdietdrugs.com. Have them send you a packet of information, you have your doctor fill it out, and you'll probably qualify for at least getting this expensive heart test called an echocardiogram. You'll probably be able to get that taken care of and paid for and find out if you have any underlying problems that need to be monitored long term. So there's a huge settlement out there, and then there's quite literally thousands upon thousands of individual cases of damage that the company's had to settle so far. And what's really frightening is that cardiologists are now hearing reports of new cases coming in. The problems are not over with. There's a lag time in some of these symptoms presenting themselves. And the problem is, as you said, Fen-Phen's no longer on the radar screen. Most people don't even remember these drugs that they took them. Most doctors aren't looking through your medical records to say, well, did you take anything 4 or 5 years ago that would suddenly cause you to have heart problems? And that's why it's so important for people to, you know, to know that this did not go away very nicely in a, you know, with a nice pink bow around it.
Mm. How many people altogether did take these drugs? Do we know?
In the United States, they estimated, because you had to do it by prescriptions, and the prescriptions were often 3 months and renewable, and let's not go there. Ultimately, they figured that about 7 million people in the States, they think, took them, maybe a little bit more. Most of them were women, and then there were a couple of million in Europe. And that's pretty big numbers. And the Mayo Clinic, when the Mayo Clinic report came out in the New England Journal of Medicine in 97 about what they had seen with the heart valve damage, they estimated that close to a third of the people who took those drugs could ultimately develop heart valve problems. The good news is, if you took the drugs only a short time and had very little damage, you probably get better. But the bad news for people who stayed on the drugs longer and initially developed moderate or severe heart valve damage, you know, they're stuck with where they are. Some of them are getting worse, and some of them are ending up again with heart transplants and open heart surgery to replace their valves.
We are a little bit past the midpoint of the program here. Our guest is Alicia Mundy, Washington Bureau Chief for Media Week, contributing editor at Washingtonian Magazine. She's also contributed to other publications, U.S. News and World Report, Philadelphia Magazine, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and is the author of this book that's just out now. It's titled Dispensing with the Truth, which looks at the battle over the diet drug combination Fen-Phen. Alicia Mundy, the guest, and St. Martin's Press is the publisher. And questions are welcome if you'd like to call in, ask a question, make comment, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I guess, you know, somehow it makes me think of Some months back, I talked with somebody about, and this is a very different problem and different product, and yet it seems somehow in my mind to be related. I was talking with somebody about hazardous baby products, things like strollers, playpens, car seats, and the horrible mechanism we have for identifying problems with them, reporting them, getting it through the regulator that in that case is the Federal Trade Commission, mm-hmm. and then getting things like recalls in place. It's
right.
terrible. It's just terrible. And you wonder in this particular, now in this case, again, sort of the same question, how is it, you know, what's the mechanism for picking up problems with drugs out there in the world and then getting that information to the Food and Drug Administration yeah. and then getting them to do something in terms of either what's on the package or actually saying that this drug should not be on the market.
If I say it's a crapshoot, this isn't going to make you feel much better, is it? But it really is. If there's anybody listening out there who's in a doctor's office or working with doctors, I have to tell you part of the problem lies with American doctors. Unlike doctors in Europe who much more routinely report side effects and they do so, I've been told, under penalty of legal retribution if they don't. American doctors, by and large, do not fill out the forms that go to back to the drug company or to the FDA. They have a patient who's been put on a drug and the patient develops a serious side effect. They treat the side effect. If there's another problem, the patient, goes on and gets more help, or the patient sues, possibly. But in the end, the doctors don't want to deal with the forms that go back to the drug company, which then the drug company has to send on to the FDA, or report it directly to the drug company. And the former commissioner, David Kessler, the FDA, used to scream about this all the time. So that they've basically figured out at the FDA that for every one report of a side effect they get, assume that there are nine more. Assume that you only get one-tenth of every serious side effect reported to you, one-tenth the number, because doctors are so reluctant to take the time to fill that out. So they have to wait till they start seeing numbers come in, and then you multiply by 10 and you figure out, oh, is this serious or not? But in the meantime, Congress, as I said, had defanged and declawed the FDA under so-called reform acts. I love the way people take and abuse language. It's like George Orwell right home. They reformed the FDA to death a couple of years ago, and basically it's not really supposed to be inspiring or provoking new studies of problems drugs once they're on the market. That's up to the company to come up with a study to chart drugs once they're in massive use. And the FDA really can't force them to do much more than that unless something big becomes such a huge problem that it's in the FDA's face, and then they finally react, often belatedly and in a haphazard way. And I give you, Rezolin as an example. There have been seven drugs that were approved in recent years, pulled off in the last 3.5 years. Rezolin, the diabetes drug, was one of them. And the numbers of liver deaths and liver disease and liver transplant cases were mounting. The reports were coming in from all over, and it basically took a combination of the Los Angeles Times and CBS News embarrassing the heck out of the agency before they finally agreed to pull this drug.
Yeah, I think what ends up surprising people is that they have this idea that something like the FDA or the Federal Trade Commission, they're supposed to be looking out after our interests. They're supposed to be protecting us, and we have this idea that, well, something hazardous is not going to come onto the market because they're going to look at it first and say, well, no, this is no good and shouldn't be. And in fact, that's not the way it works. It sounds as if we're lucky if something ends up getting pulled when only a relatively small number of people have been harmed by that thing.
And that's about what happens. And in fact, it may look like a small number, but again, if you know, as the FDA does from long-time studies, that one number represents probably 10 cases, then you can see them adding up the numbers there and finally deciding to move on something. But people trust the FDA implicitly, and honestly, these days, they should not. I've gotten calls from doctors around the country who have read the book, and one of the things that shocked them Again, going back to the whole labeling issue, because doctors, again, they don't have time to read the labels. And the labels deliberately, as designed by drug companies, contain every possible side effect so that you're completely inured to that. You don't even notice it. What you look for is there anything big in dark letters at the top or anything big in a black box. And doctors said to me, we assume that when we read a label on a drug that that's what the FDA thinks is dangerous and that's what the FDA thinks is the biggest problem there. We didn't know that these labels actually represent, you know, the results of negotiations between high-paid lawyers and lobbyists for the drug company and you know, the FDA, trying to swim against the tide. And those labels don't often represent what people at the FDA who study these drugs really want to see on the label. What they represent is whoever won the tug of war with the suits from Gucci Gulch, as we call it in Washington, the street where all the lobbyists hang out.
Yeah. And something else, and certainly you've touched on this, but something else that perhaps people don't think about is the fact that when a new drug is going to be brought on the market, we're relying on the manufacturer of that drug to do the testing. And it's not so there's no objective party that's looking at that drug. It's the people that stand to make money if the drug is approved that are doing the testing.
Yeah, and the FDA, it does review the testing, but things can happen, and they frequently do. One of the strange things happening these days is a couple of major public relations firms who have a lot of ties to the pharmaceutical industry, who have clients, have now bought into some clinical testing labs. So that in the future, what you may indeed see is that you'll see the press releases on the testing coming out before the FDA has a chance to review it, because here's the press release that will help spur the stock price. Good news, the initial test came back positive. And then there's a lot of pressure on the FDA to go along with something because it's been in print, it's gotten a nice bounce. This happens frequently. The other thing is you don't know what's actually being found in the testing because, again, there's so much pressure from Congress on the FDA to hurry up and rush these drugs through. And I give you the example what happened with Fen-Phen. One of the things that came out is there was a rat study that had been done. Most of the clinical testing for this drug, for redux and what have you, had been done in Europe with the European company. So it had been conducted there, and then that was used as part of the application for the new drug. Well, they did a rat study to look for cancer. And it came back very thick with a very nice little executive summary and everything. The good news is this new diet drug does not cause cancer in rats. And way at the back, sort of, and I'm characterizing this, but basically inside the study, there was this kind of mention of, oh, by the way, one of the side effects we did see was something called focal fibrosis, which in fact is the thickening of the heart wall, the same as the thickening of the heart valve wall, which was the problem that led the drugs to be withdrawn finally. And it's sitting there, but of course, what they're getting at the FDA is, okay, here's the cancer study. We did the cancer study the way you said for us to do, and the good news is this drug doesn't cause cancer. They weren't paid to go looking for what else it was going to cause, and there you are. Thank you very much, and you can all go home now.
Mm. And I guess maybe we made this point earlier, but to come back to this issue of the illness that was caused by these drugs, this was not something, as far as we know, a pre-existing condition. This was the problem with the lung problem and the heart problem was we know for a fact that was actually caused by the drug, that these people didn't have this problem before, but they did have it afterwards?
Well, certainly with the lung problem, because it's so rare to then see all these numbers in these people who were taking these drugs. The only thing they had in common was the use of the diet drugs. That's certainly the situation. And with the heart valve situation, in the end, the judge who is handling this huge federal case in Philadelphia involving hundreds of thousands of potential victims and some victims already, was that he finally looked at all the studies and said, in the end, the general theme is that although we don't know how it causes the heart valve, it's clear from the way the studies are going that it does cause this heart valve damage. And whatever the reason is, who cares at this point? Let's just keep these drugs off the market and start dealing with the mess that they have left in their wake.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. And other people who are listening are certainly welcome to call if you have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. So if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. And the caller here is in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I didn't quite. Am I right to think then that your estimation is that Wyeth Erst really ended up financially badly hit by their decision to go ahead and suppress the side effects?
Well, not according to Wall Street. I mean, they've paid, you know, this as far as we can tell is the largest hit that a single company has ever taken on a product liability issue like this. I mean, basically for damages, this is one company, and it's approaching $12 billion pretty quickly. But its stock price is doing well. The overall company, American Home Products, has so many other divisions and makes so many other products, children's medicines and all the over-the-counter medicines I mentioned, that you know they're doing quite well in spite of the hit that they've taken. Although I understand they've been looking around hoping for a nice merger with some other big company, but they're doing okay, but they are paying out a heck of a lot of money.
Well, I meant in terms of that product and its revenue itself.
Oh yes, I mean, I have to admit, one of the last lines I wrote in the book, which I made a point of getting in there, is they've paid out this much money, which was certainly a heck of a lot more than the $800 million at one point that their market research people was afraid they would forfeit in sales. They'd have been, better off in the first place, put the warning label on and see what happens rather than this, what this has cost them in the end.
Yeah, it seems so unusual that would happen because in so many cases. When you finally hear about what the final settlement is, despite all the problems that they may have caused by this kind of decision, they actually ended up making money anyway, because the settlements are kind of small.
Well, the overall company is doing quite well, but there's no question that this division of Wyeth Ayers took a big hit, and it's certainly got people looking sideways at what the ultimate liability is, because that still isn't certain, again, with these new cases coming in.
Well, I got two things. One is that I'm kind of interested in drug companies and their shenanigans, because I've got a couple sisters that work for drug companies, for example, and mm-hmm. for other reasons. But anyway, I was reading that in 1997, another area where there might be a lot of problems is that apparently in advertisements to doctors themselves in their trade magazines, I was reading an article on New Scientist where they were talking about how they, that at the bottom they'll say they're supporting data. We have the data, to support the efficacy of a mm-hmm. particular drug or something. And somebody in Europe picked 26 at random of these advertisements and actually went to the drug companies to get their supporting data. And they didn't really have any, so I imagine the same thing is going on in here in the States. I don't know if you know anything about that, but if not, or whether you do or not, I want to go quickly mention this other thing, because this has a question in it, and that is, I read this article of yours in Ardor in the Court in Texas Monthly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, really well written.
Thank you.
You must be a terrific writer. And the but the one thing that really left me wondering is this lawyer Petrov
uh-huh.
you were talking about, and how he managed to get the all this information about from the drug company,
mm-hmm.
and how all the other lawyers have been stymied for so long, and you don't really go into details on how he did that, but you do mention one thing that made me really curious, and you said that he was quite quick about getting depositions from people at the drug company.
Mm-hmm.
And are you implying that this guy and a lot of lawyers were thinking that he's going much too quickly and he can't be prepared
right.
for taking that deposition? Is it true that this guy must have? Did he was he like a very quick study and had to understand all the implications of what he was asking?
No, the object there was to get the company off balance strategically, because traditionally in big cases like this, companies just stall. Their main tactic is stall, stall, stall. People are dying. People are getting sick. They need to have a quick settlement. They'll, they'll sign anything and to get it out of the way, and in the meantime, the longer you can stall with producing documents and producing your executives to give their sworn testimony, the better off you are. But the object here strategically was basically to throw the company off balance. And what worked here, it's pretty interesting if anybody out there is interested in legal cases. Normally there's only one case going. In this case, Texas had its own rules, and the Texas judges don't like companies that stole. Other state lawyers around the country were pursuing cases independently, and then there was a federal judge in Philadelphia who was also in charge of a case that was going ahead. And what happened here is that lawyers began sharing all the information so that you didn't get somebody deposed just once. In the end, that, you know, somebody may take a deposition early and not know all the facts, but at that point, the executive has said some things under oath he now has to stick with. And when later on new papers come up showing that that may not necessarily be the case, it creates a real problem for the company that's the defendant in these cases, and that's exactly what happened here. People didn't get a chance to just go under oath once and walk away from things, and there were multiple chances to catch people in what they said earlier and hold up new documents that had been found. And it's ultimately one of the reasons that the company owes the money it does.
Well, one last question, and I'll get off. Would the drug companies nowadays, having seen what Petrov did, would they have some sort of defense for that?
Not really. This case has been a particular nightmare. It's been fascinating for the entire legal profession to see what happened here. But no, I mean, you can if state courts will let lawyers pursue cases individually from states instead of having to go into one federal suit where everybody's in control of the situation, it creates chaos for the company, and ultimately, it's just hard to defend against that because you can't control the situation. And as far as I know, I'm the biggest defense right now that that the firms are coming up with is going around the country saying, let's have tort reform, let's shut down the plaintiff's lawyers, let's make it impossible to sue drug companies once their drugs have been approved by the FDA, no matter what you find out later. That's their big defense right now, is trying to get Congress to make it so they can't be sued.
And there are some people who are receptive to that argument that says once a drug is approved, if there's any problem with it, that's too bad.
There's been a couple of Midwestern states where they've actually moved to start doing this in the legislature. And the trouble is, and I use my book as an example here, the FDA approved this drug, but, you know, what the FDA knew then and what the FDA knew now and what was there all along are absolutely night and day. And if you let people say, well, if the FDA approved it, it must be the drug company must have told them everything they needed to know, therefore the drug company shouldn't be held liable, you are really setting yourself up for people dying all over the place. You can't have that because it is too easy these days to use the loopholes in the FDA system to not give them all the information, one, that they need, and two, that you might already know.
You talked earlier about the fact that certainly there is a great deal of pressure to get drugs on the market, from either because there's this perception that there will be great demand. Certainly companies, if they think they're going to be able to make a lot of money, want to get their drugs out there. And it is often the case that these are not drugs that's going to save anybody's life, but they're dealing with cosmetic problems that obsess us, like our weight.
Right.
Having said all that, after having looked at what happened with Fen-Phen, one wonders, are there other drugs out there that may be causing these kinds of problems that we don't know about today, but we might find out about next week or next month or next year?
As a matter of fact, there are, and I'm not going to name them right now, but you've seen reports recently in papers about some very popular and certainly from what I've heard from users, some very worthwhile drugs that have helped them with some chronic problems, such as chronic pain. But I know that there are now new reports coming in. You see it in the newspapers about some of these painkiller drugs and their side effects, because the trouble is in stopping the pain, some of the side effects go right to your digestive system, nervous system, and others, and it's a real problem. The stronger the drug, the more likely it's going to have bad side effects. The stronger the painkiller, the more likely it's going to have some residual effects on you that you're not counting on, and that's a big problem out there.
Well, we have come to the end of the time. We want to say thanks very much for spending some of your time with us and talking about the book.
Well, thank you. I could tell that you'd actually gone through this thing. I know it's 300 some pages, so I appreciate your taking the time, and I appreciated the questions and everything. Thank you.
All right. Alicia Mundy is our guest. She is the Washington Bureau Chief for Media Week and contributing editor at Washingtonian Magazine. The book, if you'd like to look at it, is out now. It's titled Dispensing with the Truth, and it is published by the St. Martin's Press. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Corley Photography at 118 North Walnut in Champaign, providing portrait, wedding, and commercial photography service, plus the copying and restoration of old photos, 351-6222, and with an online photo gallery at corleyphoto.com. The broadcast also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, an ecumenical nonprofit shop offering fairly traded handmade crafts benefiting artisans from around the world. Tomorrow morning on the show, we'll be talking with George Fletcher about his book, Our Secret Constitution, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy. And then in the second hour, historian David Courtwright talks about a little bit about the history of drug use around the world. His book is Forces of Habit, Drugs, and the Making of the Modern World. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. We always invite your calls. And, of course, we hope that you will stay tuned, because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thanks, David. Good morning. Coming up today on the Afternoon.
Profitably, but we're just at the end of the time. Judge Gray, to you, we want to say thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity. We need to legitimize this discussion, and I think that this program has helped.
Our guest, James Gray, is judge of the Superior Court in Orange County in Southern California. His book is Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, published by Temple University Press.